O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master. Dearest Mother. Beloved David. Saints and sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Peaceless. So I'm sharing the sound. This is a short piece. Very nice. When thy song goes through me. Master was a master. This is First Corinthians chapter 7. Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. But I speak this by permission and not of commandment, for I would that all men were even as I myself. But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I, but if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. But, and if she depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife. But to the rest, speak I, not the Lord. If any brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath a husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. For what knowest thou, O wife, therefore, whether thou shalt save thy husband? Or how knowest thou, O man, whether thou shalt save thy wife? But as God hath distributed to every man, as the Lord hath called every one, so let him walk, and so ordain I in all churches. It's actually quite interesting. You can see how the Catholics came to divorce issues and things. And there's
a Hillary?
Yeah.
Oh, can you tell me where that Bible reading starts?
Oh, yeah. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. And I
want chapter 7.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1.
Okay. And is that, and tell us who the author, is it John or is
That's Paul? That's Paul, yeah. Corinthians is all Paul, yeah.
Thank you.
So you can see that the Catholics follow that fairly strictly even to this day, that they really don't think a divorce is correct. And the if you do divorce, you can't remarry. That's something that, it's always been part of the Catholic Church. It's rather interesting. I didn't quite realize it was so explicit before until I read this. But
Larry, is that the which Bible version?
Oh, that's King James Version.
Yeah, which is different than we have in the Catholic Church.
Of course, yeah.
So that might be part of it.
Well, no, I'm saying that the Catholic Church is following that very, very closely, actually. But right, they do have different translators, and there's some changes and some differences. Actually, some whole books are missing and added to others. So,
hey, Larry.
Yeah.
Could you kind of explain, there's a passage in there I don't quite understand. It says the husband will have power over the wife's body.
Right.
And the wife will have power over the husband's body. What does that mean?
It just means that to be faithful.
Oh.
That person, first of all, it must mean, too, that you must partake in sexual activity if it's required, because that is given to the wife to control the husband's body, and the reverse is true too. So it's certainly going to bring children into the world. It's funny that he didn't talk about that he didn't say, we all see marriage mostly as for children. That's what historically it's been. But he's talking strictly, more strictly about being incontinent and not becoming fornicators, those kinds of things. So,
would you mind just reading it again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good idea. Yeah. I really like that. Swami Muktananda reads things twice. It's quite good. So this is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. But I speak this by permission and not of commandment. For I would that all men were even as I myself, but every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband. But, and if she depart, let her remain unmarried, or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife. But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. So this is, evidently when he says it that way, this is my personal belief, he's saying. But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If any brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now they are holy. But, so that's where I stopped. His letters were quite mixed, had lots of things in them, touching on many subjects.
So it does mention children at the end there.
Yeah.
But more of a side.
Well, probably not an aside. I should read the rest of it, you know, but that he focuses on the relationship between the man and the woman and what works and what he recommends. But it's interesting, too, that he's saying, look, this is not God's. God is saying don't divorce. I mean, that earlier part, he's saying it's not I, but God says. And then later he says, now this is what it works for me. So this is always a fraught subject. And I think that we need to focus on, you know, this is my intent in speaking about this. I think that the focus should be on the children. But, of course, what he's trying to do here is he's trying to build an indissoluble bond. He's trying to make a strong nest for the children to come to. And the children don't have doubts about their parents. The parents have made made vows and promises to each other that they will stay together. And there's natural chemistry that brings them together, and there's natural human conditions that tend to separate them. But once we keep that marriage together, then many, many things from there can happen. Elsewhere I was reading that, and we all know, that let the woman be subservient or, you know, bound to the husband. And as Christ is the head of the church, let the husband be the head of the family or the head of the wife. And we don't really know exactly what was different. Was that cultural, or was that something allegorical, talking as mother did? She claimed, you know, she said that the reason should rule the heart. Reason should rule feelings. And that's what Adam means, or the man means, with the husband and wife conditions. There's many people who are of a different sort, and the woman is more the dominant one, or more male than the husband sometimes. Doesn't matter whether that's true or not, but there are certainly many times when there's a balance between the two, and there's a very similar power amongst each one. And reason is just as strong in some women, and just as strong, feeling is just as strong in some men. But I think the overall picture is correct, that men are less likely to cry. They're less likely to have feelings that they, and I don't say don't control, because women do control their feelings, but that they don't feel like they have to control. Now, men really do not feel the same, desire to show feelings as much as women. And that it really is a difference between men and women in my experience. But at the same time, there are, as every mix. And then Mother teaches that we have reincarnation to consider in this, because we have spent lifetimes as either sex at different lifetimes. And then we must also consider that in between, in the astral planes and the higher planes, there is no gender necessary. I'm pretty convinced that, the gender differences are needed for mechanical reasons in this physical world, and that the animal nature that was described and brought into being with the Y chromosome in human males, forming a completely different kind of person in the male. And so the animals already demonstrated that God gave Adam a mate to match that, because of the animal aspect within man, because that's what it takes also to bring children into the world. Now, we all know, too, of rishis, that they could just touch their wife and the wife could become pregnant. Papa talks about this, and so we have some reason to believe this is true in the higher yugas. But we partake in this Kali Yuga, in the Dwapara Yuga that we're in, we partake of the world at a more visceral level. And it has its snares and its problems, but it also has its joys and its real great benefits. Seems like I've been listening a lot to how miserable this world is. And of course, I know this from my own life, that it can be miserable. But it is truly a wonderful world that we see here. If we could have in the higher yugas a lot of these things resolved, where we can understand each other better, that we're less driven by our passions. Now, there's an interesting thing about passions versus feelings. Men's passions are just as more likely to be exercised upon as women's passions, and that's a control of the feeling nature. So in my example with crying or, wearing your, being more emotional, things like that, it doesn't mean that the men don't have to deal with it in different ways. I've said many times that we all think, well, gee, wouldn't it be nice if men were just nice and didn't want to have carnal knowledge so often, perhaps, or in such a violent way for some, where there's rape is even a possibility. But we have to keep in mind, in the present set of humans and the present set of people in the present yugas, that we are the recipients of people. We are the people who come from people who did want to have carnal knowledge. And so the ones who did are the ones who produce children. So it's natural that you're going to see the milquetoast type person with no libido or no interest. You see that person not having children. There's another very, very interesting thing, and that is that in general, throughout history, from an anthropological point of view, women tend to have 90-some% of the women will pass on their genes into the next generation. Men, in general, only 50%. They either die or through war and other things, they live in a more rough and violent world that they take bigger risks, and they have to do maybe the harder work that will kill them more likely, or take them out of the gene pool anyway. So it's very interesting that the ones, men who are good, sure, good, basic, decent people, do have children, and these are strong men oftentimes. But we're still contending with other, this is a This is a, I don't want to say a random or a crapshoot, but that's what's in my mind. So this is a, we take our chances when we come to this world, that we're going to have a number of people who are really so driven by their passions that they will rape, that they will dominate too, and try to dominate. And so we have to deal with that's a fact of life. We can resent it, and we can say, well, those people shouldn't be able to have children. And it makes a lot of sense that, you know, people with low IQ who are, you know, have other kind of genetic problems, perhaps maybe they shouldn't have children. I get all that. But God arranged things so that those who have libido, those who come together, those are the ones who will father the next generation. We're not living in the time of the yogis and the rishis, in which there are no such people. And we have to recognize that these elements exist within ourselves.
Larry, I'm having a problem with you talking about rape as a uncontrolled, passionate kind of thing, or uncontrolled libido, when it's actually more of an act of violence.
And right, but it still brings children into the world.
Of course it does.
That's what I'm talking about, though.
Okay, but I'm having a problem with that.
The concept of it being more of an animalistic, whether it's dominance or, right, is what he's talking about, the idea of, and that we're in an age when it's the lower things are still coming through.
Yeah, I got that.
And of course, as David said, you know, these are during these times too, the people come out of the animal kingdom and come into the human condition. So they are just more animalistic. And so, and we need to bring them along. The idea that we can cut everybody else out of our lives who are violent, and we should control them. They should be in prison perhaps, if they are a danger to themselves or to the public. But that idea that we shouldn't bring these people along is wrong. It really needs to be controlled to the best extent. And we really need a time where there's more respect paid to the higher spiritual souls among us as being the people who advise and can have leadership. So,
you know, Larry, it's an interesting subject that you brought up tonight, and and I actually appreciate you doing it. It's kind of a touchy subject, of course, but it's important for us on the spiritual path. It's important not to ignore it.
Right.
And so what I'm always curious about, you know, the rules are pretty clear, and Mother had pretty clear rules for us around not living with people without the sanctity of marriage. And, you know, her group was very young as opposed to the group now. I mean, she had a whole bunch of 20-year-olds, right? And, you know, she had her hands full kind of trying to get them to follow the rules. And she was pretty good at it. But what I've always been kind of curious about is, okay, so now you're married, and you're on the spiritual path. You know, how much sex or whatever is permissible within marriage? And you know, it's an interesting thing to think about. Mother used to very adamantly say that the marriage bed is undefiled. And I go, well, I appreciate that, you know, that kind of sanctifies marriage. But I noticed that, in Paul's, verses that he writes here, I pulled it up because, mm-hmm, having a little bit of hard time hearing every single word you say.
Okay.
And the words are important.
They are. Yeah.
And so let me see if I can find that and just go over, this is verse 5, and this refers to people that are married, and it says, defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. So he's not talking about single people. He's actually talking about married people.
That's right.
And so he's talking about actually, and this is something I think a lot about, you know, is he's talking about having some self-control actually in the marriage. And so what he's saying is, you know, spend a lot of your time, you know, fasting and praying, and then come together for a time. But he's basically kind of saying, you know, like, don't overdo it. You know, just because you're like married, you know, doesn't mean you're, you know, doing it night and day and all that. And I realize this is, it changes depending on what age you are. You know, it changes dramatically, you know, whether a couple of 22-year-olds are married or whether a couple of 62-year-olds are married. But, and so there's two ways we can kind of get something around this in terms of our conduct. One is to go to the rules, right? See what's been written on this. So this is an interesting verse, this verse 5. It gives us some rules around that. But I think a better way is to just kind of sit down and go within and say, okay, well, if I'm on the spiritual path and I'm trying to keep my consciousness as high as possible, you know, what do I do within that? Even though you're married and it's okay, and mother says, you know, the marriage bed is undefiled, how do we conduct ourselves within that marriage? And you know, it's not just you, right? You've also got a partner, and your partner has needs, wants, and desires, and you know, you want to be a good partner and all of that. But it's just kind of an interesting subject. You know, here you are, you're married. Maybe you even want to have kids. But, you know, how do you do this balance thing? And, you know, you want to keep your consciousness as high as you possibly can. And then how do you work that within that?
I read that a couple times myself, verse 5. It's one of the more difficult ones there. I don't know what exactly he means by defraud, because that's a little odd. It may have a different meaning in the time of the King James Bible, and I probably should have gone to another, you know, the new versions that are available, revised standard.
Well, I'm assuming defraud doesn't mean sitting around having tea and crumpets. This is just a guess.
Well, no, but my point is that we don't know what that means exactly, but he does say, except it be with consent for a time. In other words, mutual consent for both parties.
For a time, right? I mean, he's implying self-control in
that's
that.
What he says. He says for a time.
Right.
Consent for a time. That you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer as an example. In other words, you could be celibate, so to speak, in the marriage for as long as it's with consent and for a time. And then come together again that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. I think the defraud there is that one person will use some of these teachings that will defraud the other by talking positively. Oh, well, we need to be holier and better together, and we shouldn't have sex. And the other person is defrauded by trying to bring about a virtuous way of controlling the other. Defraud ye not one the other. I think that's really what it means. And yeah. Accept it be with consent for a time. So in other words, you want to have this time for fasting and prayer or any of the things that you can do that will be more spiritual, even traveling and doing things that are spiritual. Really, fasting and prayer can mean many of those things. It seems to me when you look at the kind of context here. And then come together again that Satan tempt you not for your incontinencies. But that warning there, that one person, one side will may not be exactly aligned with the other one, and will go along for a while, but become angry or build up some kind of resentment.
Right.
So go outside the marriage.
Oh, of course, yes. He makes that clear. He's bound.
No, but I mean
people.
It's a temporary situation so that one is not tempted to go outside the marriage.
That's no, are you saying, Jill, that that's the word, how he's using the word defraud in this case?
No, the second part.
It's the incontinency.
The second part, the incontinency, yeah. Right. So that you not be tempted.
Right.
Yeah.
I interpret incontinent as to mean just a nonstop flow of sex and not containing.
No, it really means, it really means not being able to control it and the frustration that goes with it. But certainly it's not being able to control it. So sure, it doesn't mean nonstop necessarily, but saying, and it's certainly also this, I think this is really interesting because first of all, he says that the body of the woman is given to the man and the man's body is given to the woman. So that seems to be pretty clear. He's locked people in. This is a tight marriage. This is a tight situation. You can't get out of it, you know, if you're going to follow the rules. You can't, and you, even if your wife leaves you, you shouldn't put her away. Doesn't give you the right to remarry. She might come back. She might become reconciled. It's really interesting.
I also thought it was an interesting passage where, you know, and many couples are in this circumstance where one of the two is on the spiritual path.
Right. And he even talks about that.
Isn't. And so it says if one of the two in the couple is on the spiritual path and the other one isn't, the one that's on the path sanctifies the other.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah.
And I thought that was a really, and you're right. And it sanctifies the children. So I thought that was a really interesting passage.
But this is pretty tough stuff in a way. You know, the Jews were allowed to divorce. And as far as I know, they've always been allowed to divorce. He doesn't use the word divorce, but he's saying, hey, this is, if you want, that's fine. If they want to break up the relationship and move out, that's fine. But you can't get married and that person shouldn't get married.
But you know, we have all these really interesting examples. Mother Hamilton got divorced.
No, I'm not saying because of these things.
Papa just walked out the door and left his wife. So, you know, there's like, we kind of have to reconcile, you know, what is initiated by God and driven by God and what is, you know, sort of like man's rules for conduct. Like, you know, try and conduct yourself this way. But if, you know, if God.
Well, and interestingly, he says that the divorce is the one of the few parts of that he says, now this is from God.
This is from God. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah.
The rest of them, he says, this is my opinion. This is my opinion.
Right.
This piece is from
God. And so Mother's just saying, look, she had differences with Master. Master makes a proclamation or something, and everyone thinks they have to live up to it, and they should. It's their guru. But she said, you know, she attained her own connection to God, and she felt differently about some of these things. And though Master allowed her to get divorced, by the way.
But, you know, we've all heard about these super, super abusive marriages, right? Where the guy's...
Those are always brought up. But
I think she's obligated to leave him. I mean,
she was treated very badly.
Yeah, you can't, you know, you can't condone that.
But, you know, at the same time, this is, you know, Paul was pretty strict about these things. He's trying to set a pattern, you know, asking for the impossible to get the possible. So in a way, I think he was dealing with people who were, a lot of them were Jews. So they were dealing with people who were, you know, divorce was okay. Also, he was dealing with people who didn't have a religion of that sort, a Semitic religion, but were actually more Roman citizens. And I believe, I don't know really the strong details about that, but being divorced or even bringing in another person into the marriage bed and things like that were maybe more common. I don't know on the common level, but certainly it was true of the upper echelon people.
Well, and I think when it says put away your wife, I think that was more literal than, you know, the woman left the husband literally put away the wife.
Right. She was his chattel. You know, she was his. He owned her and he could
him to say that that the man's body belonged to the woman would have been revolutionary.
I know. Well, and that a man shouldn't put her away. She might become reconciled. Wow. So some of these things are dealing with the times of the Romans, the people living at that time, both Jews, but also maybe more because he always did, you know, do things for the Gentiles.
I think that for us though, for the edge that, you know, the razor's edge that you're walking is how to have a full marriage or a full relationship in that way and still be always going to God, you know, always trying to raise your consciousness. So, in other words, we're always talking about that being a householder is not it doesn't have to be an impediment to going to God.
Right.
And so this is, I mean, for our purposes here, what we're talking about, I think, is how do you go to God? How do you lift your consciousness and still have a marriage and partake in that? And, you know, have a mutually beneficial relationship. And, you know, sex is part of life. It's all, you know, how it's used and it's even how it manifests.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And yet it can be an impediment when it becomes a horizontal draw.
Of course.
So it's allowing that energy to flow up the spine instead of out through the sexual centers.
You know, I also think it's really
monitoring when that's most efficient and taking long breaks from expelling that.
I always think it's interesting when older people are dictating how younger people should act. You know, it's I know an awful lot of young men where they go, oh, burn in hell for eternity if I do this. Okay, I'm down for that. You know, I mean, it's just very, very powerful. And
Mother called that burnt ash, you know, burnt offerings, right?
Right.
Because in other words, it's easy to do it when you don't have any libido. Oh, I'm as funny as can be. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think it's really easy to say, oh, yeah, you know, if you're single, you need to abstain. And maybe that is what you should do, but I still think it's important to consider.
I think Paul was really an amazing person. He really was trying to juggle all the balls and keep things balanced in a way. He's setting this as a special condition that comes with the teachings that he's bringing, you know, and I think it's pretty interesting. I don't think everyone can live up to these things. He says Satan can tempt you, you know. Of course we can all be tempted, but he said,
and he says if you're tempted, then get married.
Right.
Keep it within the marriage.
He also seems to show that he is celibate. Because he said, and he's holding that up as the idea.
And of course, we don't know how old he was when he wrote that.
And also St. Francis was that way. He let his disciples become married, get married, and leave. But they had to leave the order, of course. And then, you know, there's that famous scene in the Brother, Son, Sister, Moon with the one young man is so enamored of a woman. But
Caesar scrubbing in the room there.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, he was completely okay with that. So this has been on my mind is because of The Chosen, one of the things I love about it is that Jesus talks to Simon's wife. So this is where this all comes from in my own puzzling through this and interested and really, you know, there's so much rich stuff in the Bible and some of these teachings. But one thing that's always been missing is some of these details about what did Simon do with his wife and stuff like that. So in The Chosen, they have Jesus talk to Eden, Simon's wife. It's a beautiful scene. It doesn't maybe hold up completely. It doesn't. Wow, it's kind of interesting. She's very high-minded, and she sees the good in Simon and Peter. And he says to her, you were the first to see this in him, weren't you? I hold you very highly because she thought she was at the point in the relationship. She was not being considered nor was she important. And Jesus just chose a time when they were just alone. And he doesn't set it right. He just gives her all the love and he gives her full credit for recognizing what the leadership potential and the goodness of Simon, of Peter. And that's how he approaches her. He brings her into the thing. She says, though, this is the harder part. Well, I know he's got to work to do for you. And I'm thrilled that he's doing that. And even though she's admitting implicitly, it's hard on me. Yeah. And then another thing that brought this up is in The Chosen, you know, these are fanciful notions here, but still they make you wonder about it. And that is Thomas is quite enamored of a young woman. So there's basically three women who follow Jesus around. Ramiya or Rami, something like that, R-A-M something. And then Mary, the mother of God, and then Mary Magdalene. And then there's an Ethiopian woman, too, who comes into the – makes it a foursome. But Thomas falls in love with this other woman, and he wants to marry, and Jesus gives him his blessing. In fact, even arranges it so that he can travel while he's doing evangelical work for Jesus, as he's told to go and preach. in my name, that kind of thing. Well, during that time, he says, and by the way, when you get there, you can talk to her father and get permission. So Thomas is saying, oh my gosh, I had no idea. It was just, not that it was going to be that easy, but that I had to, that you, of course, Jesus, you already know all my thoughts. And but he's countenancing that. And that's not in the Bible. What did happen to people who were married? So very interesting.
That power, Peter, that you're talking about, especially for the young people, if you imagine when you run that up instead of out, it's, and that's the gift that we give to the younger people, is to help them experience that at least once or twice.
You know, and maybe even more important is to know what in the world is happening to your body when you go through these experiences. First of all, yes, you're right. You then know that you should direct it up. But by knowing about it, you can say, oh, so that's what's going on. Oh, it really does. I really do feel this moving up the spine and not. And I've just lost all interest in my lower part of my body, in the animal nature. And I don't mean just the head. I mean clear info, right. The animal brain, all of that. I've lost all interest in that. And this happens. We go through this at different times. So the idea that this can happen can shock people if they didn't have a teaching of mothers and the teachings of Kundalini, all these things.
I think, celibacy, I think, is a tremendous thing when you come to it naturally. When you're talking like you are, Larry, about, the energy rising in your spine and you suddenly lose interest. I think the weird things happen when celibacy is imposed. I think for a whole bunch of folks that aren't ready for it, and that's like 90% of the population. So a good example is the priests, right? The Catholic priests. Well, they're supposed to be celibate. That's an idea that's put forth, but they're not ready for it. So it comes out in all kinds of weird, examples. And I think this is true in many, many cases. I think it has to be a voluntary thing. I think it has to be where you're evolved to that point, or I guess a better way to say it is if it's your idea. But if it's imposed by an outside structure, it's going to get weird, like every time.
Yeah, if you're shoving it down, if you're not sublimating it,
Right.
If you're not repressing it.
Repressing. Thank you, Larry. That's
mm-hmm. Well, there are some people who are natural at it. They just don't have
the. Sure. They're evolved.
May just be low libido, too. There's a difference in chemistry in people.
Sure.
Some people just are very quiet and they don't really care about some things. They might have intellectual pursuits of all that.
Kind of an amusing thing in Victorian times, they had to put like these little doilies, these little skirts on the legs of tables. They thought this would be too provocative. And so, you talk about what repression does to people. That's what it does to people. It's like, don't think about pink elephants, and then all of a sudden, all you could ever think about is pink elephants. So, it's an interesting balance, to try and point people in the right direction without creating this repressive atmosphere that actually just ends up fostering it.
And the design isn't to say don't have sex. The design is to try and see, to try and work with closing the flow to the sexual organs, shutting that doorway and allowing it to move up instead of out.
When I was young, I came to this path very early and I would ask Mother about this, and I would say, some people say, well, why do young men act the way they do? Well, jump into their body for 2 seconds.
Testosterone. I'll give you one word, testosterone.
Why are they crashing their cars into telephone poles? Well, there's like an explanation. So I was talking to Mother once and I said, this is really powerful, Mother. Like, what can I do about this? Why is this so powerful? And she said, she looked at me with this big smile. And what I loved about Mother is she understood. She really did understand. And she said, it's the force that created the universe. And I thought, wow, no wonder it seems so powerful. Mm-hmm. It's the creative force.
Yeah. And it will take you to God, all the way to God.
Yeah, if it's used in that way. Absolutely.
You know, Mother told me that karmically, what's most important to a devotee is to not involve others. So if you involve others in this, in other words, a prostitute or an affair or things like that, it's much worse because of what you're doing to that other person. You're involved, and also karmically, you're wrapping yourself up. Everyone makes a big deal about, you know, sex being more important than anything else. And there's the thing that really binds you together, and it does in a marriage, but that every sexual act has to be accounted for. It has this huge impact on you and all that. Look, I don't really think that's necessarily true, but when you do these kinds of things that are wrong and you involve others, then you are really.
I must be missing something, because I thought that was kind of the point of.
Others outside of the marriage.
Mother's trying to show that it's not just wrong to have an affair for sexual reasons or sexual release. It's really wrong to have an affair with someone else. She's trying to amplify that aspect. That the what's really wrong with it is involving others, because you bring them down in. And
you're being Satan in that act.
Or they're bringing you down. I mean,
no, but you're entwining yourself between the two of you. So there is all friendships, everything you make, we all get entwined with each other. But this particular thing is only for pleasure, especially in affairs and prostitutes. It really does tie you at another level, and it will have. Things that are more difficult for Mother to sort out. And I think that's what she was trying to get through, was to beware. She was very interesting on this matter because, you know, she often said too that, she said, you know, in some respects, sex is kind of disgusting. If you think about it, it's kind of a disgusting
thing. Messy.
And then she says, but between a man and a wife, it can be the most beautiful thing in the world.
Well, between two people that love each other.
Yeah. Right.
That's what makes sex beautiful.
Right.
It becomes intimacy at that point.
Right. And she wasn't saying for children. She wasn't saying for children either. She was acknowledging that, certainly.
Mother had a powerful life. And she told us that. And you could tell Mother had a lot of life force. You know, she wasn't one of these milquetoasts that you're referring to. I mean, Mother was all there.
I think she had a very passionate relationship with Father Hamilton. I think she kind of implies it.
She told me once something about men being attracted to her. And she made some passing comment. I thought it was really cute. Now, here she is about 73 years old, and she goes, she kind of rolls her eyes, and she goes, you know, this is something I've been putting up with my whole life. And I'm thinking, boy, that's got to be pretty rough, Mother, having all those men after you. And then another time, she's about that age, and she told me that she had received 3 marriage proposals in the last 2 months. All, of course, from men that are way younger than her. So she had that animal attraction, you know, that animal magnetism. I mean, she was all there. And I mean, this is when I met her, I thought she was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen. I can't imagine what she was like when she was 25 or 30. You know, so when she's talking about this stuff, this isn't from some aspect of somebody that, you know, never partook of anything or didn't know what she was talking about. She knew.
She did, yeah. And so final thing, Mother also said that you need to have someone love you to get you through the final realization. Now, she never clarified that exactly, but she said she thinks it's better to be married. To attain God, to attain final liberation, because of what she saw in India with some of the swamis there. They were
That's what I'm talking in. About, that kind of forced celibacy. It just doesn't work out too well.
Well, I mean, it can work out. There are examples of it. Forced celibacy can be on someone who becomes a widower, or a man or a widow. Also, you know, you can have it enforced in that sense. So it's not always like, oh, the mean man is forcing me to do this.
There's trying to go find partners. You know, that's, they're free to go find partners. That's self-imposed.
Yeah. No.
That's
no,
self-imposed.
No. No.
No. No. What?
They're not Indian woman.
No, according to the rules, Kate, I'm saying if they want to go find partners, they have free will. They can go do that. This is not forced celibacy. This is self-imposed celibacy. That's
many the of the made. Many of the swamis and that. It, I mean, yes, there's kind of the rules, but in a lot of the ones, you know, that we've come across, this comes from their own spiritual discipline. It's not a forced thing necessarily. And
it's expected of them, though. He's right about that. It's expect you see a Catholic priest, and you expect him to be celibate, and you're disappointed if he's not. But you're also recognizing he's a human being. In fact, you can feel sorry for some of these men. I think, you know, when you get to you at 15, and then you're a priest at 25, that's, you know, it's pretty tough to know that how long is this going to last? You know,
right?
It seems like I can do it, you know, and so it is enforced by circumstance and by societal norms. But my example with the widows or something like that is it does get forced upon you. You can't just go and get married that same day. You still have to deal with these things at different times. So anyway, I think it's really, really interesting what Paul says about this and the positive, in looking at it in a positive light, dealing with what he was trying to do. I think also he's asking for the impossible to many people, because we know that not very many people live up to it nowadays, and probably not a lot of people did in those days. But can you set a model like that? It's a tremendous thing, because it's a lot of sentences here. It's not just saying, oh, just get along and don't get divorced. Doesn't say that. It's very nuanced, logical thing, and the rest of it's very interesting too.
I also think for society, there's a very practical reason for a man and a woman to stay together, and that is if there's children that come out of this union, you know, you need those two people there in that household to help make it in the world and to help raise these children. You know, it's very, very tough for these single mothers, as we've seen. You know, once I was listening to a radio show and they said that the single greatest precursor to poverty isn't the family that you were raised in. It isn't your race. It isn't what country you're from. They said the single greatest precursor to poverty is if it's a single parent household.
I was just thinking about when, you know, these things that Paul was saying, and then you're talking about the Jewish society and other societies that they came out of. And, you know, a lot of people these days think that Christian religion is very repressive and very, you know, too many rules, and they're all but, and it's, you know, against women. But when you think of what he is saying and the early church, it was actually very liberating to women because Jesus did have, you know, he acknowledged women, and he had, he at least had some kind of relationship with them in the sense that he talked to the young
people. These rules are there to protect women and children. That's what they're there for.
But I'm saying that this by Paul is they look like equal partners in terms of how he's
in charge of the man. Much more so, yeah.
He's in charge of the woman, the woman's in charge of the man. And in the early days, the Christian church was actually raising the status of women more than what it had been in other societies. So it is interesting to see that from these words, that it is much more equal partnership than we would think.
I think you're right. I think it's really, really noble, some of this stuff and the circumstances that they were undergoing at that time. It's really high-minded. It's not all, there are some very negative things, and there are some very, you know, bad things from that era that are kind of, for instance, a lot of people talk about slavery. But, you know, it's funny too, though, there was a desire to raise up even the slave as being someone to come to church. This is true about the people who studied the early church. A rich woman could go to church and have her slave in the same church, not necessarily would bring her with her or any of that, but it was accepted that she would, when she entered that church, she was an equal with everyone there, even her own slave. But anyway, there's some criticism of the church and the Bible that it doesn't talk against slavery as much as it could, and that kind of think that it's possible that it was taken out, or it just was considered a fact of life. It was everywhere. So that final thing, just to complete the thought, though, because it's so revolutionary on Mother's part, is that she said, I think it's better to be married. You have to be, here's what she said. You have to be loved for yourself. You've got to, if you're not, you will not be able to get past that final thing. And this is what she saw in India. So there's these swamis and sadhus and renunciates who couldn't get beyond something that would come from a marriage. And of course, it's too late. They're already in their 60s, 70s, 80s. They're not going to get married and have a normal thing. So she saw Swami Ashokananda in this dilemma where he couldn't seem to get past that.
Was that her words? You have to be loved for yourself?
Have to experience that love for yourself. Now, it can come in other lifetimes. Okay. You can be launched into this lifetime and get past it. She acknowledged all that Master was above all of these rules anyway, but also that Master probably didn't need it. He was well above that position already. But for the average person, beware that celibacy being imposed from without or whatever isn't the only, because also she's fighting against this insistence of the monastic world of SRF and all that's the only place where you can get the real truth, and we're the real holy ones, and these people living like Mother and the other Yogacharyas and other ministers, they're not there, they don't have the real goods, and they're not even celibates, you know. That's something that's always there, and it's been with the Catholic Church, the Christian Church, for a long, long time too.
You know, another point I want to make is that, you know, there's certain emotions that create separation from God quicker than any others. I think one of them, a real obvious one, is fear. But I think another really strong one that seems to stick with people longer, and perhaps in that sense it's more destructive, and that's shame. Yeah. And an awful lot of shame comes around sexuality, particularly as it's presented by the conventional churches.
Agreed. Yeah.
And so, you know, people say they go to these cultures in the South Sea Islands or whatever, and they just don't have any of these connotations attached.
Taboos, yeah.
Yeah, and they seem so much more free. And I'm not advocating free sex. That's not the point of this. The point is that in this effort, like what Paul has written here, to make us do good and make us be on the proper path, if you deviate from that, and as human beings, sometimes we're all going to make mistakes and we're all going to deviate from the path. If this tremendous amount of shame comes with it, and some in the past, you know, that's really been aided by society, you know, that's a great separator from you and divine consciousness, is I'm not worthy. Right. I'm a worthless sinner. I'm a whore. These are terrible things to have going through your head when you're trying to ascend. You know, so it's this subject is a really delicate subject. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of good balancing that needs to go on here. Because you don't want somebody to make some little, you know, dariance or, you know, when they're 16 years old or whatever, and have this tremendous sense of shame for the rest of their lives. You know, that's not productive. That's not helpful. And unfortunately, we seem to have put that on the women, you know, in our society over the years, where men seem to get a little bit of a free pass on that.
Mm-hmm. These are facts of life.
Again. You could say that again. I mean, I'm coming from a place, I worked with domestic violence survivors. I worked with, you know, Bridget Collins. So I was immersed in all that. I'm glad I'm not anymore, but I can't unknow what I know.
I'm wondering, Larry, if this topic came to your mind, because it kind of took me by surprise today, because I thought we'd be... Anyways, by Swamiji kind of wondering about David getting married, that was kind of... He was kind of surprised that he got married again,
right,
when he was at the stage where he was at in his.
It's all of a piece, isn't it?
Okay, I just wondered so if that was what kind of came into your mind at that point.
So in my experience, I find most Catholic priests and most celibates from young life very, I hate to say immature, but very, what is it about them? Naive. They seem, not just that they're not worldly, of course that's true, but that they are really pie in the sky, too Pollyannish for their own.
You know, the irony is that they're tasked with counseling married couples.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, There's so much in society that, you know, we can compare our present system to. I know we all think we know what the ideal society would be, but if we do have some faith that there is a golden age and a higher yuga, as David always said, you know, as where Krishna could be the king, you know, it wouldn't be just somebody, a lottery of voting is fine. I think in the present condition, it's actually the highest, best chance of success. But the best circumstances is to have a benevolent, saintly leader who's acknowledged by all. And this is the way they tell the story of Rama. He's coming out of the golden age and starting the Treta Yuga. So he's starting into the Dwapara Yuga. And he's coming from the Treta Yuga, but he is everyone acknowledges him as king, except for Bharata's mother, who thinks.
Except for the bad guys.
Well, Bharata's wonderful, but his mother is really the problem. She becomes the tool the god uses to start it all. And Rama says to Bharata, you know, don't you say anything bad about our mother. You know, he has three mothers, according to Rama. You make your peace with her, so you cannot talk about her that way. So even though she did this horrible thing to Rama, he didn't care. He could see what God was doing.
I think if we've seen anything from the examples of our own gurus and the holy people that we know, is that this is very circumstantial. And it's good to have rules and it's good to follow the rules. It's really best to just keep your mind on God and try and do the right thing. But you know, David went through a divorce and he wasn't planning on getting remarried. And then he married Carla. Well, that's all at God's direction. You know, none of that's in the rule book. You know, and you have to trust that that's what guides David. You know, there's a lot of people that were really upset when he married Carla. There were people that left the group when he married Carla. And you have to have faith. I mean, that this man is doing the right thing.
Well, and David tested that spirit over and over and over again.
And Swamiji wasn't being critical when he asked. He just was curious.
He was just.
He said, when David wrote to Swamiji, he said, that surprised all of us.
Surprised David.
Yeah. So I explained
that's right.
That could be. But I explained to him what I think it is, and we've talked about this before, all of us, I think, that it is, mother was married and she promoted that. Lahiri Mahasya was, Sri Yukteswar was. So marriage itself is not a bar. In fact, by the way, Swamiji said marriage is not a bar. That's the very word he used.
Yes.
It's not going to bar you from realization. So don't let people convince you of that. That's what he was trying to say. It was a wonderful thing to say. David knew that in their condition, in their society, him being a spiritual yogacharya and being married didn't compute. But
right.
David was trying to show something else, and I think he was trying to honor mother's teachings about all of this. I really think that's what he was doing. And I think also Carla at that time was so good for him. She was one person who didn't give him trouble. She could work with him without what was the word I've used before? But she didn't befuddle him, and she didn't constantly nag and need and pull from him. She didn't drain him of energy.
He could just serve.
And he knew that about her. So
I think the point of this is, I think rules are great. I think rules give us a good starting point and a structure. But ultimately, you follow God's will for you.
Of course, always, yeah.
And that's all the examples that we have before us, including the most difficult one of all, and that's Papa.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
You know?
Wappas is so lovely, though, because you look at the outcome of what he did, even within his family. And Prem is the son of the daughter that he abandoned. And you look at what a beautiful soul
he was. It's tremendous, but none of that was known at the time. I mean, ask his wife how she felt about it. You know, I mean, it was rough sailing.
Well, there's many examples of saints leaving their wives and their families and becoming saints and not having happy people at home. Neem Karoli Baba also had, interesting situations at home. And Nicole said, was worried, Mom, you're not going to stay there, are you, when you go to the ashram after she visited there?
She met Monsi and heard what happened.
Yeah, good point. She thought she met Monsi.
And so she said, are you going to do that too, Mom?
Well, the outcome of my divorce turned out really well. I got to meet David and get on this path, and Max turned out great. He's a wonderful young man. I wish he would marry his girlfriend that he's living with, but, you know, what can you do?
No, exactly. You can't do anything about that.
He had David's blessings, too, as he was growing up, which was...
Yes, he did. And I called him right when I was leaving for the retreat, and I just said, hey, I just wanted to say hi. I just wanted to tell you that there's a saint here from India, so you won't, be angry with me for not telling you later. Oh, I'm going mountain biking. And I go, okay, fine, no problem. Love you and everything. And then right after, now he has COVID. And he's like, he called me up to tell me he has COVID. He never calls me. So it's kind of funny. But then he said, I'm glad you got to meet a saint, be with a saint this weekend. So it's like he knows.
But, all of our kids, all of us have kids that are in varying stages of understanding and commitment, and it's hard to get the commitment. They think we're a bunch of nuts, let's be clear.
Well, Nicole grew up on mother's lap. And she's just kind of neutral.
But, you see these big pictures in our room, in our front room, and all this. Man, what am I got myself mixed up with? I'm always amazed, and Kate and I have mentioned this many times, people come into this house and they studiously avoid the topic. They don't look.
Oh my God,
they
cold, just, cold. Yeah,
they studiously avoid the topic now, except for our friend Jillian, who just came a couple weeks ago. She's one of the few people who's actually talked about.
And an Indian person who comes in and says, "Oh, is this your Guruji?"
That's the difference.
But I wanted to tell you all just because the house just felt so full of spirit today. Just ringing with all the energy that having Swamiji and Sundar here and all of you coming and others coming too. And Swamiji was very happy. Mm-hmm. Both of them were very tired. Sundar was kind of sick last night. He felt better this morning, running a fever, sore throat and everything. So they retired early, but both are up and ready to go again this morning. And Swamiji was very, very happy about it all. And we said, we had, at least you had a little bit of downtime on Friday. And we were going to go to the mountain. And we didn't get a chance to do any, showing you any sightseeing. He said, but it was so beautiful up there at the retreat. I got to see those sights.
That retreat, Kate, was like the perfect retreat. I mean, it was so amazing. The setting, the people that were there. We got to meet brothers and sisters from other groups.
No kidding.
Delightful. Really. I mean, it's just one of those weird things that just turns out about 10 times better than you think it's going to.
It was all the energy from the ashram coming to be with us, and all of our, all of our expectations to make it a special time and to realize that it was a special time. And so everybody came with that intention and
You can learn so much too. I learned a lot from the Indian folks that came, the devotion, the bringing the food, how much cooking all the women did. And then I was talking to Sundar, and he would always refer to the women, no matter who they were, as mothers. Mm-hmm. And I found that so delightful and so kind of uplifting. And I think that's, I'm going to start doing that either, you know, out loud or internally just with myself. Start, you know, thinking of these women as mothers, and it just lifts them up. It lifts your idea of them up. It's just a wonderful, we can learn so much by their example. And it was quite so delightful to be around. Mm-hmm. And the devotees, you know, the former ashram, the current ashram devotees, and all their stories. And it was a tremendous time.
You know, we have a wonderful story about Kate's grandmother. Her mother was actually a very good leader in scouts and stuff like this and church things. But her grandmother was not too shy. But she said to her mother, you know, we don't know, Kate, you can tell the story better. But at any rate, she said, I can
watch. She said, after my mother had been, was leading this little group, you know, it was just a little church Bible study or whatever. My mother had given the meeting, and they had all had their tea, of course, because it's Scottish Presbyterian. You have to have your tea afterwards. And then my grandmother said, well, I really admire you that you can do this and you can get up in front of people. My grandmother only had a third grade education too, you know. So, and she said, but what I can do, I can wash the dishes.
And I want to promote this endeavor. I want to promote this endeavor. I can do that, and I'm glad to do it. I want you to think this is so. This also occurred with this last few days. I don't know if it was Bhavani or Chitra, but this is the two mothers of the Indian mothers of the friends we've met just recently. We love so much because they brought so much food. But it's so true what she said. She said, she went into the kitchen and she was helping Kate or doing things. She just took over the kitchen a little bit. And it was either her or Bhavani said.
Bhavani was the one, yeah.
Okay, so she said.
They both did, I think.
They both felt it. You could tell they both were maybe talking to each other because they said, this is something we can give to Swamiji. Don't take this away from us.
Food.
Now, that was implicit. She didn't have to say it that way. But she said, this is something, I love this. I'm good at it. That's the other thing. I spent years doing this.
Yeah.
I'm not a slouch. This is something I can offer. And it's needed. And it's my greatest joy to do it for Swamiji. What a sweet, these women, I tell you, they're so wonderful. Because they're so clear about these things. You know, if they're a Mary and not a Martha, okay. We have plenty of understanding of that. But we need to look at the Martha who's not complaining.
The joy of serving.
Well, and to look at what as Kate's grandmother was, this is what I can do, and it needs to be done. And it promotes the thing I love here with my daughter taking care of this group. You know, this high-minded stuff is what keeps the society together. It really is what knits everything together. So, anyway, it was a lovely time. I know, Kate, you wanted to maybe talk about the weekend, and I think maybe we should do that next weekend on your birthday.
Well, no, I just
no, I think we should. I struggled with this. I thought maybe halfway through this we could switch on. I think it's fine. I like the way it turned out, but I think we should talk about it with before memory's gone too much, and we should to just talk
and
about
kind what of another what like. Another take home kind of things after we've already had a week. How is this? How is this impacted us? Has it lasted? Have we taken something with us from the whole experience? Because certainly raised a whole bunch of points that we've all, you know, maybe we've been introduced to a lot of them. Some ways of Swamiji has such a wonderful way of encapsulating an idea and presenting it, and some of those things we maybe haven't thought about in that way. And there's little things that you can grasp a hold of that really work for you, you know, and so it'd be interesting to see what our takeaways are next week, you know.
I always think of the admonition to seek the company of saints.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that the whole weekend, is seek the company of saints.
You've got the human birth. You've got the desire for God. That's, you know, Shankaracharya said the three great boons are to have a human birth, during that birth to want to seek God, and then the company of saints. So, yeah. So you may as well just focus on company of saints. You already have the other two, Peter.
Right.
But we should also mention another woman who did food, and that was Jill.
Right.
Wonderful, wonderful thing she did.
That's really amazing. Thank you, Jill.
It was simply amazing to watch you.
She made the whole dinner Friday night, I think. Wasn't it Friday night? It was so good.
So many things, yeah.
So fantastic.
And I kept going, and not to diminish Jill at all, but I kept walking by the kitchen, and I see a number of the busy bees in there who were really doing a lot on the dinner.
Oh, Mira whipped together some fantastic dish. I got this a little morsel at the very end that was just fantastic. All great mothers.
She made that dosa for Swamiji with.
Yeah.
So that's, anyways, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing with all of us there.
Great blessing.
Yeah, it truly, truly was.
And Swamiji actually said, well, the next time I come, I should.
He was saying on yesterday afternoon, or am I off a day?
No, it was only yesterday.
Yesterday afternoon, he was saying, this trip to Seattle,
Oh, I heard him say that too, yeah.
You mean more so than all the other towns, the Pittsburghs and the New Yorks and the...
We don't really know, but he was...
That's gratifying.
You could see it was not a waste of time.
Yeah, he was...
That's sweet, Jill. I'm glad you said that.
Called this morning. I was out of the room. Larry answered the phone. And he just... You can tell them, Larry. He just said, what to say?
He said... who knows what he said initially. Om Shiram. And then... I think he just said, I know what it was. It was just, I didn't have anything to say. And he just wanted to call me because first Senator called me and then he says, here's Swamiji. And so he turns it over to Swamiji. Swamiji's thinking, now we don't know who instigated this call either, but probably Swamiji wanted to do it and Sundar made it happen.
Yeah.
That's the way things really happen. And so anyway, he said, what to say? After a few minutes, just a few minutes of quiet, what to say? What to say, but to say how grateful we are for the time we spent with you.
He said that?
Yeah.
How grateful we are what?
For the time we spent with you.
Because at one point he said to Sundar, these are real devotees.
Yeah. Mm. Not us, but he means everybody.
He means the whole group.
He loved that group at the yoga place in...
Yeah.
He loved all those. He said that they were so attentive. These are good souls. And we had told him beforehand, he wanted to know, are these first starters or are these more mature? And I said, these are people who are meditators. They know a lot about the higher teachings.
Notice when they're all listening, there's no fidgeting.
I know.
It was silent.
No talking. It was just complete attention.
Well, and he was kind of directing it towards them, the way he talked about yoga, asanas.
Yeah, true.
And how to bring that into your life.
He won them over.
He asked us, well, is this a yoga place? Well, will they be all doing yoga? No, they won't be doing that here, but they, you know, other places in the building, they do have yoga classes. They will know about yoga. And he decided then to, well, do they know about the higher things about the yoga? And I said, yes, they will, but he wanted to address that. So that was good.
And then the questions were worth it all by themselves. Those four questions were just, because he's such a good teacher, and you give him a subject that he's thought about a lot. Like those four questions were things he really knows well and deals with them at the ashram. So, wow. So it should be all recorded, by the way, too. It should be, Sundar should have it up. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, it's 9 o'clock, so.
It was a wonderful, wonderful weekend.
Yeah. And, you know, really wonderful that some of you could come all the way down again. One more time, getting in the car, driving down. That's great.
That was my great pleasure.
Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram,
Jai Ram,
Shri Ram,
Jai Ram,
Jai Ram. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel
in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am
He.
Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.